alone.
No, he says again. And I do as he orders. He makes no sound, only smiles as he closes his eyes and takes his last breath. And I take my first breath as leader of a remnant, charged by my grandfather and commander to hold on to hope. I'm not sure I can. Grayson Ballinger, 14. Chapter 4. Kazi.
Livestock pens were broken and scattered like tinder, and the stink of scorched grass burned our lungs. Rage blazed beneath my skin as I took in the destruction. Ren and Sinove rumbled with fury. Our task suddenly fractured and multiplied like an image in a shattered mirror. In the end, the anger would serve us. We all knew it. Our sham excuse for coming here, investigating treaty violations, had suddenly grown, full-bodied, sharp, all teeth, claws, and venom. The settlement consisted of 4 homes, a longhouse, a barn, and multiple sheds. They had all suffered damage. The barn was completely destroyed. We spotted a stooped man, furiously hoeing a garden, seemingly oblivious to the carnage around him. When he saw us coming, he raised his hoe as a weapon, then lowered it when he recognized Ren's cloak made with the patched fabrics of the Marasi clan. My leather waistcoat was embossed with the revered Thanis found on the Venden shield, and Sinove's horse had the tasseled noseband of the clans who lived in the eastern fens, all distinctly Venden if you knew what you were looking for. "Who did this?" I asked when we reached him, though I already knew. He straightened, pushing on his bowed back. His face was lined with years in the sun, his cheekbones tired hills in a sagging landscape. Partial faces peeked around doors and between cracked shutters in the dwellings behind him, more settlers too afraid to come out. His name was Camus, and he explained that the marauders had come in the middle of the night. It was dark, and they couldn't see their faces, but he knew it was the Ballingers. They had come just a week earlier with a warning to the settlers to keep their shorthorns off their land. They took one as payment. Ren looked around.
Their land? Out here? In the middle of the Camlan Tau?
It's all theirs, he answered. As far as they can see, according to them, every blade of grass belongs to them.
Sinove's knuckles whitened with rage. Where's your livestock? I asked.
Gone. They took the rest. I guess it's payment for the air we breathe.
I noticed there were no horses either. And the ravians that Morrigan gifted you?
Everything's gone except for one old dray horse for our wagon. A few of the others went into town to buy more supplies. They won't be able to get much. Venden's pay a premium.
His jaw was set hard, his fingers tight around the hoe. Venden's didn't scare off easily, but he said he was afraid some might be too fearful to return to the settlement. You won't be paying a premium to anyone, nor payment for the air you breathe, I said. I took a last look at the damage. It may take a while, but reparations will be made to you.
We don't want more trouble from...
The other settlers will return, and it is you who will receive payment. He looked at me, doubtful.
You don't know the Ballingers.
True, I answered. But neither do they know us. And they were about to. Hell's Mouth was 20 miles away. It was a remote, mysterious city, far from the seat of Islandia, that few knew anything about, other than it was a growing trading center. Until a few months ago, I had never heard its name. But it was supposedly a large enough town that it offered the opportunity for buying and trading for the settlement. I was tired and irritable as we rode. I hadn't slept well last night, even in my tent. This miserable, flat wilderness pecked at me like a relentless, sour bird, and it seemed impossible that any sizable town existed way out here. It felt like I hadn't taken a deep breath in days. Sinove chattered nonstop, and I snapped at her like a shrill crow when she brought up the Raka again. "I'm sorry," I said after a long silence. "I shouldn't have jumped on you." "I'm afraid I've run out of fresh subjects," Sinove answered. I was truly wretched. And she was right. She knew. I didn't like the silence, and she was only trying to fill it for me. I was used to the noise of the city, the constant hum, the bang, the wail, the sound of people and animals, the tinny patter of rain on roofs and the slosh of wagons in muddy puddles, the chant of street peddlers trying to entice someone to buy a pigeon, an amulet, or a cup of steaming Thanis. I longed to hear the roar of the river, the jingle of soldiers as they marched down a lane, the heave of 100 men pulling the great bridge into place, the sounds of remembrance bones clacking as they swung from 1,000 belts, all of it teeming together like something alive and whole on its own. All those things helped me to hide. They were my armor. The wind-swept silence left me naked. "Please," I said, "tell me about how they give birth again."
"Eggs, Kazi," Ren interrupted. "You weren't listening."
Sinove cleared her throat, her signal for us to be quiet.
"I'll tell you a story instead."
Ren and I both raised our brows, dubious, but still, I was grateful. It was one she had told many times before, but she often added an unexpected twist to make us laugh. She told the story of the devastation, the way the Fenlanders told it. She reverted to her thick, easy drawl. The angel Aster played large in this version. The gods had become lazy, not tending to the world as they should, and the ancients had elevated themselves to godly positions, soaring among the heavens, ravenous in power, but weak in wisdom, crushing all in their path. And so Aster, who was guardian of the heavens, swept her hand through the galaxy, gathered a fistful of stars, and threw them to Earth, to destroy the wickedness that dwelled there. But there was a remnant on the Earth she found to be pure of heart, and to them she showed mercy, leading them away from the devastation to a place of safety behind the gates of Venda.
And to the Fenlanders, of course, supreme over all, she gave a fat roasted pig with a glittering star in its mouth.
Every time she told the story, Aster always bestowed the Fenlanders with a different gift, usually a fat, juicy one, depending on how hungry Sinove was at the moment. Ren took a turn too, telling the story with the details from her own clan. There were no roasted pigs in her version, but plenty of sharp blades. I had no version of my own, no clan that I belonged to. Even among Vendans, I was anchorless. But one thing was constant in all the versions I heard. The gods and angels destroyed the world when men aspired to be gods and mercy had fled their hearts. No one was spared except for a small remnant who found favor, and that was how all the kingdoms began. But as the queen often warned, the work is never over. Time circles, repeats. We must ever be watchful. Now, it seemed, we needed to be watching the Ballingers. Wren had the eyes of a hawk and called out first.
There it is!
Hills rippled the plain in the distance, and scattered ruins finally appeared, flecking the landscape with rich, lush shadows. But far beyond them, tucked at the foot of a misty lavender mountain, a dark blotch grew larger. It took form and color as we got closer and sprawled like a giant beast lying at the feet of its brooding master. What kind of beast was Hell's Mouth? Or, maybe more important, who was its master? An oval of deep green appeared to hover over it all like a foreboding spiked tiara. Trees? Strange, unearthly trees. Nothing like I had ever seen before. Sinove sucked in a breath.
That is Hell's Mouth?
My pulse quickened and I stepped up in my stirrups. Mija snorted, ready to break into a gallop.
Not yet, boy. Not yet.
Glimpses of ancient streets began to appear, like the backs of subterranean snakes surfacing as if they traveled just below us.
By the gods, Wren said. It's as big as Sanctum City.
I took a deep, relaxed breath and sat back in my saddle. This was going to be easy. The city was just inside the border of Islandia, a lesser kingdom shaped like a large falling tear, and Hell's Mouth was at its apex, distant and remote from the rest of the kingdom. Just outside the border, the Ballinger stronghold overlooked it all, but their fortress was impenetrable according to a report the queen had received. We would see. Unlike the Sanctum and Venda, there were no walls around this city, no great river to hold it prisoner. It ambled with the boldness of a warlord, nothing daring to hold it back. Its homes and hamlets reached out with strong, crooked fingers, and the whole city seemed to be hemmed in only by the circle of trees that towered over it like a mystical wreath. There were multiple points of entry, and far off we could see many other travelers making their way into the city, too. While still a good distance away, Wren picked out a suitable abandoned ruin as we passed, and she and Sinove stowed some packs there before we continued on. Though many travelers entered the city, when we rode in we drew stares. It could be they saw the Venden crest on our tack, or maybe they saw something in our faces. We weren't there to buy or sell goods. We weren't there for any reason they perceived as good. They were right. Wren hissed, shook her head, grumbled. I don't like it. She pulled out her zeith, spun it, and shoved it back in its scabbard, the hilt snapping against the leather. Sinove and I exchanged a glance. We knew this was coming. It was Wren's ritual, as she recalculated every risk in the minutes before we actually took the risks.
You sure? They're a powerful family. If they lock you up, yes,
I answered before she could propose something else. It was the only way this was going to work. Like I told Grizz, I said, our gazes meeting, I've got this. So do you. She nodded.
Blink last.
Always, I confirmed. There were all kinds of unwritten laws that we lived by on the streets. Wren knew that was one of mine. Blinking last wasn't just an occupational tip to reel in a target. It was a survival aspiration. We proceeded forward, gawking at the strange city, taking turns pointing out oddities, like the web of rambling structures looming overhead, where the thick, muscled arms of tree branches held them securely aloft, rope suspension bridges connecting them to more structures, homes, shops, even a large, sprawling inn that ascended into the trees, shadows upon shadows and endless paths to follow. The architecture of the city was a mix of old and new, ruins repurposed into homes and shops. The pitted ancient stones of another time were joined and fitted with newly polished marble. In some places, the giant trees were a staunch troop of sentries huddled close together, their trunks as wide as two wagons, and only dappled light danced through their soaring canopies. In the center of town, the sentries took a step back, leaving an opening for the sun to shine unobstructed into Hell's Mouth. It shone now on a white marble building ahead, giving it an ethereal glow. A temple. It was the focal point of a wide, circular plaza that was thick with people, bustle, noise, and everything I loved. I paused, taking it all in, and then for a handful of seconds, I held my breath. It was a fruitless habit I couldn't shake, and I scanned the crowd for a face that haunted me, but was never there. I sighed with both relief and disappointment when I didn't see it. As we circled around, I noticed that the avenues were laid out like the spokes of a wheel with the plaza at its center. We found a livery to feed and water our horses, and while Ren and Sinove got our horses settled in stalls, I asked the stable master for directions to the magistrate's office.
"Right here. You're looking at him." The magistrates I had met in Roh Lao didn't muck stables on the side.
"You also enforce the law here?"
"I keep watch. There's 10 of us." His shoulders pulled back and he squinted one eye. "What's this all about?"
I told him who I was, here by the authority of the King of Islandia, which was only a slight stretch of the truth, and also by the Queen of Venda, to investigate treaty violations. He didn't try to disguise his slow perusal of me from my boots to the sword and knives belted at my side. His gaze lingered there.
"Don't know anything about violations."
"Sure you don't." I moved closer, and he eased back a step. Apparently, even he knew of Ratan. "As an enforcer of the law for your king, I instruct you to tell us anything you know." He shook his head and shrugged. "Nothing." I was ready to twist the little weasel into a braided loaf, but it was too soon for that. I had bigger game to hunt. "There are Vendans here in town buying supplies. Have you seen them?" He seemed relieved to see me on my way.
"Sure,"
he answered, now eager to talk again.
"Saw them headed that way this morning."
He pointed down an avenue across the plaza.
"There's a mercantile there,
where Vendans have the privilege of paying double." He shrugged his indifference.
"Don't know anything about that either. But I'll tell you, folks here are loyal, and the Ballingers own this town. They always have."
"Interesting," I said. "Are you aware that Hell's Mouth is part of Islandia and not the Ballinger dynasty?" A smirk lifted the corner of his mouth.
"Hard to tell the difference sometimes. Half those here have some relation to them, and the other half are in debt to them."
"Really? And which are you, magistrate?" His taciturn demeanor bloomed again, and he only grinned. I turned and left, but was only a few steps away when he called after me.
"Just a friendly warning. Be careful whose toes you go stepping on."
"Friendly." I gathered up Ren and Sinove, and we asked a few questions as we made our way to the mercantile. The responses we garnered were similar to the magistrates. They knew nothing. I wasn't sure if it was because we were Ratan, or if they were too afraid to speak about the Ballingers to any form of law. Outside the mercantile, a striped awning stretched over barrels and crates brimming with food. Grains, dried beans, salted meats, pickled hocks, colorful fruits and vegetables, all displayed in neat rows. The abundance surprised me, but it always did when I traveled to other cities. Inside, the store appeared to sell more food and other wares. Through the windows, I viewed shovels, bolts of fabric, and a wall full of tinctures. A dray pulled by an old draft horse was parked nearby, and I wondered if it belonged to the Venden settlers. As we approached, I watched a clerk chase off children who were playing near stacked crates of oranges. My tongue prickled. Bright, luscious oranges. I had tasted only one in my whole life, when I stole into the home of a quarter lord. I was searching for something else, but found it sitting on the middle of his table like a revered ornament. I sniffed it, then joyously peeled it, scattering the dimpled skin across the tabletop so the quarter lord would see that his treasure was appreciated. With every tear of the peel, I breathed in the heavenly spray of its scent. As soon as it passed my lips, I knew it was divinely inspired and had to be the first food the gods ever created. My cheeks ached with the memory of golden wedges bursting in my mouth. Even the way it was fashioned had fascinated me, impossibly organized into neat little half moons packaged in gilded perfection. It was the first and last time I had had one. Oranges rarely made their way to Venda on Pravisi wagons, and when they did, they were a luxury reserved only for quarter lords or governors, usually as a gift from the Komisar, like the other rarities that only he could conjure. I understood the children's lust for the mysterious fruit. A woman leaving the mercantile called to the children, and they ran to the dray, jumping into the back, taking the goods she carried from her arms. Once the goods were stacked, their eyes turned longingly back to the oranges. Ren called to the woman in Venden, and her eyes immediately widened, surprised to hear her own tongue. Here they spoke Landese, which was essentially identical to Morrigese, the predominant language of the continent. Once we were close, Zenove asked, "Are you from the settlement?" The woman glanced nervously around her. "Yes," she said quietly. "I'm afraid we had some trouble. Some of our provisions in an outbuilding were burnt, so we had to come to the city for more." She told us that this had used up the last of their money. I heard the fear in her voice. Her group had come here to avoid the starving seasons of Venda, where life could not be scraped out on the devastated and fallow land. A colossal Venden army had been disbanded in hopes of something better, but the something better was turning into something else for them, a harshness of a new kind. I explained that we were Bataan, sent by the queen to check on their welfare, and asked about the raiders. Her story was the same as Camus's. It was dark, so they couldn't see. But the Ballingers had demanded payment. "Where are the others you came to town with?" I asked. She pointed down the street and said they were gathering what they needed from various shops, and they all planned to leave as soon as possible. When I asked if the mercantile had charged her double, she looked down, afraid to answer, saying softly, "I don't know." I eyed an empty burlap sack in the back of the dray. "May I borrow that?" Her eyes pinched with worry, but she nodded. I shoved it into Ren's hands and signaled for her to follow me. She immediately knew why and rolled her eyes.
"Now?"
"Oh, yes. Now," I answered, and walked over to the clerk who supervised the merchandise under the awning. I pointed at the crate of oranges. "How much?" I asked. His response wasn't quick, instead inventing an answer just for me. He had seen me talking to the Venden woman, and by now had probably guessed I was Venden too.
"5 grelos each."
5. Even as a foreigner in these parts, I knew that was a fortune. "Really?" I replied, as if contemplating the price. Then I grabbed one and tossed it into the air. It landed with a firm slap back into my hand. The clerk's brows pulled down in a deep V, and his mouth opened, ready to bark at me. But then I grabbed another and another and still another, juggling them in the air, and the clerk forgot what he was going to say. His mouth hung agape, his eyes twirling along with the spinning oranges. I smiled. I laughed. Even as a knife slid through me, the same knife that had slid through me 100 times. And the more I smiled, the more I bled, the faster the oranges twirled, the hotter my anger burned. But I laughed and chattered as I had so many times, because that was part of the trick. Make them believe. Smile, Cassie. It is just an innocent game. It was a trick I reserved for the most suspicious quarter lords, those who had no mercy or compassion for any of the street rats like me. Even though the prize was only a half-rotten turnip or a square of hard cheese to fill an empty belly, it was worth the risk of a lost finger. Each victory would get me through another day, and that was another trick of surviving in Venda. Make it one more day. Die tomorrow was another one of my rules. How many times had I hypnotized merchants this way? Smiling to deceive them, spinning to rob them, drawing crowds to their stands to make them forget, using near misses, calls to those in the crowd, and tossing the same fruit into their arms to distract them so they never noticed the ones that disappeared. The clerk was sufficiently mesmerized as I continued to grab orange after orange, juggling, tossing, and redistributing them into a tall, neat stack in another crate, even as I discussed the wonder of oranges and how fine his were, the best I had ever seen. One thrown to a crate, one dropped into the waiting burlap sack at Wren's feet. Once 4 were safely ensconced in the bag, I juggled the last piece of fruit onto the pile, making a perfect pyramid. The clerk laughed and admired the stack in wonder, never noticing a single missing orb. Your oranges are lovely, but I'm afraid too steep for my pocket. It didn't pass his notice that several townspeople had wandered over to watch the show, and now were perusing his goods. He handed me one of the smaller, scarred oranges. With my compliments. I thanked him and returned to the dray, Wren following close behind with the sack. Even the children were not aware of what was inside. I sniffed the scarred orange, inhaling its perfume, then dropped it in with the others, tucking the sack between other supplies for them to discover later. We continued down the street to talk with more Vendans we saw leaving the apothecary. That was when I spotted trouble coming. A throng of young men, full of swagger, and a night of carousing, judging by their disheveled appearance, walked toward us. The one in the middle hadn't even bothered to button his shirt, and his chest was half exposed. He was tall, his shoulders wide, and he walked like he owned the street. His dark blonde hair hung in disarray over his eyes, but even from a distance, it was easy to see they were bloodshot with drink. I looked away, exchanging knowing glances with Sanove and Wren, and we moved on. Carson Ballinger, patriarch of the Lawless family, was my ticket into Tor's Watch and the center of our target. This sloppy group was not the kind of trouble I could be bothered with.
Chapter 5. Jace.
I felt a shove and my face slammed into the floor. Wake up! I rolled over and saw the bench I had fallen from and Mason looming over me. I squinted against the bright light streaming in through the tavern windows and reached up to feel my skull. Certain a cleaver was lodged in it. I cursed Mason and reached for a hand up, then noticed my bare arm. Where's my shirt? Anyone's guess. Mason answered as he hoisted me up. He looked as bad as I felt. I'd bought drinks for half the city last night, and I was certain just as many had bought them for me. There were no grand coronations when a new patre was named, though at the moment it seemed a far better idea than the rites that had passed last night, and I didn't remember half of them. Everyone wanted to be part of a ritual that only occurred once every few decades, if we were lucky. This one had come too soon. I spotted my shirt strewn across the bar and stumbled over to it, kicking the boots of Titus, Drake, and others sprawled on the floor as I went. "Get up!" Gunner groaned and grabbed his head just as I had, then vomited across the floor. The smell made my own stomach lurch. "Never again," I swore beneath my breath. "Never." "Up!" Mason yelled to them all, then said more quietly to me when I winced at the noise. "There's visitors in town. Vendin soldiers. Ratan. At least that's what one of the magistrates is saying. They're asking questions." "Son of a bitch," I hissed, but not too loudly, still rubbing my temple. I grabbed a half-empty pitcher of water and splashed my face, then threw on my shirt. "Let's go." The avenues were crowded. The first harvest had come in, and farm workers swelled in the streets, spending the fruits of the season on everything Hell's Mouth had to offer. And the Ballingers made sure no need was unmet. Traders from other kingdoms rolled in, too. Everyone was welcome into Hell's Mouth. Except Vendin soldiers. Especially not ones asking questions. Ratan, the Queen's elite guard. Maybe I could turn this to our favor after all.
"There, up ahead. That must be them," Mason said, his eyes still bleary.
Half of our crew still lay on the floor back at the tavern, but I put my hand out to stop Gunner, Titus, and Tiago, who followed behind us. I wanted to observe these Vendans first, see just what they were doing, and they didn't seem to be asking questions. There were three of them outside the mercantile. Women, and one of them was juggling. I blinked, thinking the magistrate had made a mistake. This was a girl I might have eagerly bought a drink for last night, but there was no mistaking she was outfitted for trouble, a sword hanging from one hip and two knives from the other. Her long black hair hung loosely over her shoulders, and she laughed and chatted with the store clerk as she continued to juggle, and then... I jabbed Mason.
"Did you see that?"
"See what?"
"She just nicked an orange."
"At least, I thought she did." I rubbed my eyes, uncertain.
"Yes, she did it again."
"Let's go," I said, moving toward her. She spotted me, her eyes connecting with mine, slowly perusing me like I was a bug, then nodded to those with her and they walked away. Like hell.
Chapter 6 Kazi.
We intercepted the Vendans leaving the apothecary, a husband and wife. Their eyes were lined with fatigue. Leaving Venda for the unknown was not an easy choice, and yet it was their only hope for something better. The fact that they were still here, trying, showed how desperately they wanted to make it work. The settlement locations had been carefully chosen, approved by every kingdom in advance, usually near sizable cities, so there was a greater potential for trade and growth and protection. But they were receiving the opposite here. It wasn't only the major powers of Morrigan and Dalbrek who wanted the Vendans divided and dispersed. The lesser kingdoms did too, afraid of their numbers and the strength they had once amassed. But the Queen had never held it out as a threat. Only that it was the right thing to do. These were people who hoped for a brighter future. Troops would come if disputes couldn't be resolved, but before troops came, a darker trouble needed to be uncovered here, discreetly. Any whiff of what we were really after, and our prey might vanish entirely, as he had before. "Not this time," the Queen said. I saw the ghosts in her eyes. Even for her, I thought. They never go away.
So you can't identify the attackers either? I asked.
No, we...
What's going on here?
I sighed. The bevy of bacchanals had followed us. I turned and faced them, eyeing the bloodshot leader of the group.
Move along, boy, I ordered. This doesn't concern you.
His eyes went from bloodshot to flaming.
Boy?
He stepped closer, and in one swift movement, I brought him to his knees and slammed him up against the apothecary wall, a knife to his throat. His crew jumped forward but then stalled when they saw the blade firm against his skin.
That's right, boy. Call off your misbegotten posse and move along as I ordered, and maybe I won't cut your pretty neck.
His muscles strained beneath my grasp, his shoulder a knot of rage, and yet the knife was snug against his jugular. He considered carefully.
Back off,
he finally told his friends.
Sensible, I said. Ready to move along?
Yes,
he hissed. Good boy, I said, though it was now clear to me that there was nothing boyish about him. I pulled the knife from his belt and shoved him away. He didn't protest or try to double back, but instead took his time to stand. He faced me and waved back the others, who were ready to jump to his defense now that his neck was safe from my knife. Seconds stretched, and he studied me as though he was memorizing every inch of my face. Revenge burned in his gaze. He lifted his arm, and Ren and Sinove tensed, raising their weapons. But he only raked his thick hair back from his face, and then, his eyes still boring into mine, he smiled. A chill danced up my spine. Smiles like his unsettled me. I had a history with them. They meant something else, but he only dipped his head in goodbye and said,
I wish you a pleasant stay in Hell's Mouth.
He turned and walked away by himself, his friends going in the opposite direction, as though he had sent them some private communique. I knew about subtle signals. Ren, Sinove, and I often used them to silently communicate our moves. But if he had used one, I hadn't seen it. I puzzled over it for a moment, then returned my knife to its sheath, eyeing him as he disappeared down an avenue. Sinove and Ren did likewise with their weapons, and the noise around us, which had hushed with the commotion, slowly resumed. I turned back to the couple, but they both stood stiff, their eyes wide with horror.
It's all right, I said. They're gone. Do you know who that was?
The woman asked, her voice trembling.
It was
the Patre,
her husband answered before I could finish. I had a very clear description of Carson Ballinger, a robust man, somewhere near 40, dark brown hair, dark eyes, a scar across his chin, and the swaggering dirty blonde was not remotely him.
The Patre is Carson Ballinger, I said. He's...
Carson Ballinger is dead, the man replied. He died yesterday. That was Jace, his son, the new Patre.
New Patre? Carson Ballinger dead? Yesterday?
No, they were mistaken. I was told that Carson was young, fierce, and healthy. How could...
The ring. My stomach spun. The gold signet ring. It was on his finger. I caught a glimpse of gold when I held him against the wall, but I didn't think anything of it. It was supposed to be on an older man. My mind whirled, and I felt myself being whisked down an unexpected path.
I could see Natia raging already, Grizz roaring, and the queen burying her face in her hands. I sucked in a deep breath. There's still time to save this. If I was going to get under anyone's skin other than Carson Ballinger, his son was the next best choice. This could still work. In fact, maybe it was perfect timing. I looked in the direction he had walked. Alone. He had wanted me to follow him. I was told that Carson Ballinger had a large ego. It was obvious his son did too, maybe bigger. He wasn't going to let this humiliation go. Guard the end of the street, I told Ren and Sanove. Don't let his crew follow me. And I went after him. It was a quiet avenue, strangely void of anyone, lined with the backsides of shops, trash bins, and the trunks of giant trees. Shadows crisscrossed the buckled and rutted cobbled street. I couldn't see him, but I knew he was here. Somewhere. I felt the hot trail of rage he left behind. Yes, I wanted him angry, but not so much that he would kill me. That was not part of the plan. It was eerily calm, and I pulled my sword halfway from its scabbard, scouring the shadows on either side. I listened for sounds, and a little farther down the road I heard a scuffling noise, a grunt, a soft clatter, a repeat of the same sounds. I turned my head, trying to pinpoint where it came from. I took another step and determined it came from an intersecting lane only a few yards ahead. I stepped forward, cautiously, and saw him, but not in the way I expected. He was bound and gagged, blood running from his temple, and he was in the grips of an enormous man almost the size of Grizz. They both spotted me, and I stepped out into the middle of the lane. "What do you think you're doing?" I called. I didn't think it could be a trick. The blood was real.
"No concern of yours, Missy. Just cleaning up street trash. Go about your business."
I pulled my sword free.
"Let him go," I ordered. "Nah, I don't think so. He's a strong one. We'll get a lot for him."
And then I spotted a hay wagon not far behind them both, with tall sides and a heavy tarp thrown over the top. Labor hunters? A vision swirled before my eyes. A long-ago voice I couldn't block out punched the air from my lungs. I blinked, trying to force the memories away.
"By order of the Queen of Venda, I demand that you release him now. He is in my custody for treaty violations."
Jace Ballinger's eyes grew wide, and he groaned and struggled beneath his gag, but the man's arm was a vice around him. For a moment, I regretted taking his knife. He might have avoided this quandary. The man grinned.
"You mean he's under arrest? Well, if you put it that way."
His voice was thick with sarcasm, and the memories clawed me again. "You'll bring a nice profit." Jace groaned louder.
"Release him! Now!"
I ordered. It was then that I heard a sound behind me. I whirled, but it was too late. Something hard and heavy struck my head, and my feet flew out beneath me. My cheek crashed into the muddy cobbles, and I caught a hazy glimpse of boots shuffling near me, stepping on the sword that was still in my hand. I felt him pull it from my grip, his boots scuffling closer, the toe of one nudging my shoulder, and then the cloudy haze darkened until it was black. I thought it couldn't get worse. I didn't open my eyes when I first woke, trying to get my bearings, listening instead to the noises around me, feeling the rock and sway beneath my back, sweat trickling between my breasts, the throb of my head,
something sharp cutting into my wrists. I slivered my eyes open. My wrists were chained, but worse, my boots were gone and my ankle was shackled to Jace Ballinger. He sat across from me, his gag gone, swaying with the wagon, the side of his face crusted with dried blood, the rest shining with perspiration. He saw that I was awake. His expression was grim. He was probably far beyond angry now, and most certainly fantasizing about how slowly he would kill me if he ever got the chance. His scrutiny was smothering, and I turned my head. That was when I caught the view out the back of the wagon. There were no trees, no streets, no mountains or even hills. We were in the middle of a wide-open plain with nowhere to hide and nowhere to run. How long had I been unconscious? This was more than an unexpected turn. It was an unchecked slide into hell.
Chapter 7. Jace.
The last thing Gunnar and the others would have expected was for me to disappear in a hay wagon. Keep the Straza at your sides. My mother had said it 100 times. Her order was as matter-of-fact as brushing the hair from our eyes every time we left Tor's watch. I had heard it since I was a child. These are uncertain times. She said it to my father, too. It was her goodbye. We had become numb to it. The times were always uncertain, and our Straza were always there, a presence at our sides like a knife or sword. They only had to be seen, not used. The main difference between Straza and everyone else was their title, and maybe the severity of their scowls. My brothers and I were all capable of fighting our own battles, and we had one another's backs, usually. But we didn't see this battle coming. I was blind with rage when I signaled Mason, the faintest nod to the side that he read and understood. Go with the others or she won't follow. Circle around and meet me at the livery. This rattan is going to cool her heels. I was still blind with rage as I walked down that alley. Boy? She didn't know who I was, I figured that much, but I also knew it would be only a matter of seconds before the dawning came and she'd be trailing after me. Move along and I won't cut your pretty neck. She said it with venom and sincerity. She would have done it. There was no doubt that she was driven. By what, I wasn't sure. She didn't even know me. But I was driven too. This was my town, and she wasn't going to spit out orders. As soon as I started down the alley, I should have known. My father had always warned me. If something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. Trust your gut. In those first steps, something seemed off, but my gut was woozy with a night of ale, and halfway down the alley, my stomach caught up with my rage, and I doubled over to vomit. As I wiped my mouth, an anvil pounded in my head, and I blamed it on her. That was when the labor hunter hit me, knocking me to the ground. I hadn't heard him approach and didn't even understand who or what he was at first. As he gagged and bound me, I thought maybe he was Rattan too. But then he called to another man farther down the alley, saying I'd bring a good price. And then she appeared and demanded my release. I looked at her now, lying across from me. She hadn't stirred all morning, and I wondered if she would wake at all. I didn't know why I tried to warn her that the brute was sneaking up from behind. Maybe because I saw her as a chance to get away. I'd seen how fast she could move when she kicked my legs out from under me back in Hell's Mouth. I mulled that over too. Or maybe it was more like I seethed over it. My stomach was still raw, empty. The hunters hadn't given us anything but water since they took us yesterday. I watched her chest barely rise, her breaths so shallow sometimes I thought she wasn't breathing. He'd hit her hard, and I guessed she had a good-sized egg on the back of her head. She had hesitated in the alley when she spotted me, as if something had distracted her. Her demands had disappeared and a puzzled expression had crossed her face. Maybe it was only seeing her prey snatched from beneath her nose. Ratan. I turned the word over and what I had thought it meant. I had seen Ratan before in Rajnavad, but none had been like her. They looked like killers and brutes, and they were big. She barely reached past my shoulder, and they sure as hell never juggled. Nothing about this added up. Could she be an imposter? Someone sent by Paxton? But I had overheard her speaking Venden when we first approached. No one spoke like that around here, except other Vendens. Her lids fluttered. She was finally coming to, but her eyes remained closed, even though her chest rose and her breaths became fuller. She was awake, just assessing her predicament. I could tell her. It was bad. Very bad. Scum like this hadn't ventured close to Hell's Mouth in years. They feared the Ballingers. But with settlements moving in, they probably thought they could too. Give up a handful and you will lose it all. My father was right. All the Ballinger generations had been right. We would give up no more. Not a single fistful of soil would be shared. Her eyes opened and her gaze shot to her chained hands first, then our shackled ankles, and finally her eyes rose to mine. I said nothing, just stared at her, letting it all sink in. Still plan to arrest me? Maybe not. I had already spent the whole night trying to loosen the chains or pick the locks with a sliver of wood I had pried from the wagon. The locks were secure, and we were stuck. She turned her head, staring out the back of the wagon, and for the first time, she flinched. If it was fear, she muffled it quickly and pulled herself up to sit against the side of the wagon. She winced as she rose. I wondered if she had broken anything when she slammed against the cobbles. Half of her face was still covered with dirt. She looked around, finally taking note of the others chained in the wagon. Six of us all together. Welcome to the party, I said. She looked at me unflustered. Her eyes were smoky golden moons, her pupils pinpoints. Shrewd, scheming. Or maybe it was just the blow to her head that made her look that way. Her focus turned back to her chained hands and then she stared at our shackled ankles again, examining them for long, studious minutes. I suspected that rankled her the most. If she hoped to jump out of the back of the wagon and run, I was her anchor. She slowly surveyed the others. We were the only ones with leg shackles, maybe because of our position at the back of the wagon, but all their hands were similarly bound, like ours. Their expressions were empty, despondent. I recognized two of them from Hell's Mouth, one from the cooperage and another from the smithy. Her gaze shifted to the driver. She studied him for a long while, too, and then her chin lifted, as it had when she told me to move along. I knew something was coming. Driver, she called. Stop the wagon, I have to pee. The driver laughed and called over his shoulder. You missed piss break, darling. You gotta go, you do it right there.
I'd rather not, she called back.
And I'd rather not listen to your caterwauling. Shut up! Her eyes narrowed. I nudged her with my foot. Don't, I mouthed. He had pummeled one of the other prisoners senseless when he wouldn't stop moaning, and I didn't want her messing up my own plan for escape. I had spotted an axe under the driver's seat. Easy to get to if the opportunity arose. A grin lit her eyes. A grin? What was the matter with her? She was going to push him.
Let it go,
I whispered between gritted teeth.
Driver, I really need to pee.
He whipped around, furious, but before he could speak, she said,
I'll give you a gift for your trouble.
His rage turned to a chuckle. I already got all the valuables off you. Sword, knives, vest. Those fancy boots. She leaned forward.
What about a riddle? Something to occupy your mind for all these long, dreary miles? That's a treasure in itself, no?
His expression changed. No doubt any proposal containing the word treasure caught his greedy attention. When there was nothing tangible left to take, this prize appealed to him.
"Give it to me," he demanded.
"Pee first, riddle first," she sat back. "Very well. But I warn you, you won't get the answer until I pee." He nodded, happy with his deal, and told her he was ready for it. I watched her expertly pushing him against a wall, but I wasn't even sure what the goal was. All this to pee? I didn't think so. "Listen up," she instructed, her voice cheerful, like it was a fun diversion for her. "My gaze is sharp, my scales thick. I jump, I pounce, but I'm still not quick. I have 2 feet, yet cannot stand. My head is full of rocks and sand. I breathe out fire, but my light is dim. I'm easy prey to chance and whim. My chest is empty, the treasury bare. I do not grieve, for it was never there. I am less than nothing, and more of the same. A white chit tossed in a high-stakes game."
"A lizard," the driver guessed immediately. He made more guesses, focusing on only one clue at a time, not putting any of them together. "A desert, a horse, a dragon." She answered no to every guess, and he shifted angrily in his seat. He ordered her to repeat the riddle several times. She did, but all his guesses only garnered a no from her. The more his frustration grew, the more at ease she became. Her hands stretched, fingers wiggled, as if anticipating something.
"Tell me,"
he demanded. "Pee break," she replied. He roared a string of curses, then yelled, "Whoa!" pulling on the reins. He shouted to the hunters ahead of us who were scouting the path, "Hold!" His face was purple with rage. He jumped down from his seat and stomped to the back of the wagon. I had no doubt he intended to beat the answer out of her.
"Tell him," I whispered. "Now! I don't want to be chained to a bloody pulp."
She peered at me and smiled. "I've got this, pretty boy." I wondered if she had lost all sense when she was hit in the head. She reached up and pulled her shirt from her trousers so it was loose, just as the driver appeared at the back.
"Tell me," he growled. "Now, pee break after."
"How do I know that?" He grabbed her shoulders, jerking her forward. She leaned into him, and in a single move, as smooth as air, she palmed the keys, hooked at his side without so much as a tug or jingle, and slid them beneath her shirt. "All right," she said, caving to his demand. "All right, here is your answer." He pushed her away, waiting. "A fool. An empty-headed fool." She tweaked her head coyly to the side. "And I was so certain you would get it." For once, he didn't miss her point, and his arm swung, the back of his fist meeting with her jaw. She fell back, and he glared at her.
"Who's the fool now? I got the answer, and you got no pee break. Piss your pants, bitch."
He stomped back to his seat and drove the wagon forward again. She sat up, getting her bearings, blood trickling from the corner of her mouth, and her eyes met mine. Even the others hadn't seen what she did. She motioned toward my hands. I leaned forward, and she slipped the keys from her shirt, and with a slow, guarded motion, unlocked my chains. I quietly laid them on the floor of the wagon. The others noticed, and I pressed my finger to my lips so they wouldn't make a sound. I took the keys from her and did the same with the chains on her wrists. The others rustled anxiously, seeing what was going on, and thrust their hands out to be freed too, the clinks of their strained chains making a ruckus. The driver thundered back over his shoulder,
"Quiet!"
We all froze, and then I cautiously unlocked the man next to me. He took the keys and did the same for the man next to him. The girl kicked my foot and nodded at our legs as the keys traveled out of our reach. Our ankles were still chained together. I waved to the last two men to pass them back, but they were panicking, unable to get the key in the locks, afraid the driver would turn and see them. I pressed my fingers to my lips again, warning them, but one began struggling and sobbed to the other,
"Hurry!"
The other prisoner freed him at last, but not before the driver turned and saw what was happening.
"Scatter!"
I yelled, hoping for distraction as I lunged for the keys that had fumbled from the last man's fingers to the floor. The others ran over us, jumping from the back of the wagon, kicking the keys from my reach. The driver was screaming, alerting the